What I do sometimes remind people of is there is a spectrum of failure. And so at the very end of the spectrum, you might think of this as the naughty end of the spectrum, for want of a better word, coming into the office late, coming into the office drunk, being a pest at the Christmas party. These are failures that are absolutely intolerable. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have your praiseworthy failures. So there are two ways to build a widget. Well, we try both. One of them fails and one of them, succeeds. Well, we've learned something.
Jamie Dobson, you're the co-founder of Container Solutions. It's a consultancy behind some of the world's boldest cloud native transformations. You've helped companies like, what I understand, Adidas, Shell, Volkswagen, to rethink how they do things. And you're also the author of a book, Visionaries, Rebels, and Machines: The Story of Humanity's Extraordinary Journey from Electrification to Cloudification. Now, that's a hang of a mouthful. If you were to take complexity and distill it to simplicity, what in one sentence would you say is the message of your book?
One sentence, it's the story of how humanity discovered electricity in the light bulb, and like a baton in a relay race, was handed from one inventor to another to another. And what started off very small became cloud computing and then artificial intelligence.
And why?
Well, that's a good question. I think for me, you mentioned some of the customers we've worked with. One of the greatest challenges for managers and leaders is that actually the technology moves at such a fast pace, it's hard to keep abreast of it. One of the big themes in the book is that technology changes, but human nature doesn't. And so managers, they look in all kinds of different places for techniques and tips and tricks. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. But the exact same environment that Thomas Edison created at Menlo Park and Robert Oppenheimer created in the deserts of New Mexico gave rise to this great creative environment that led to inventions. So we can learn lessons about management and leadership from the past that are applicable today. So it is a book that helps managers and leaders succeed in this emerging world of artificial intelligence.
And you talk about people remaining the same in a sense, in the way they think, if I understand you correctly. Now, in the corporate world, there's been traditionally an emphasis on compliance, that thinking the same, that I like the way you think, that's why I kind of hire you. Now, you talk about rebels. Now, rebels have traditionally had a very negative reputation, so to speak. Yet you're positioning rebels as something, as someone to be desired, someone to be looked after and sought out. Tell me a little bit about your view of the rebel that you've got in mind.
Well, if you want to use the technologies of today to invent the technologies of tomorrow and gain competitive advantage, you need a different type of thinking. What you just described about compliance and essentially what I would call execution is what happens to a business when it's settled on its business model, its technologies are serving it well, and you want to increase, your profits by driving down costs and increasing revenue. So after the explosion of invention from Alexander Graham Bell and people like Elijah Gray, we had the telephone system. But then, in the hands of a man called Theodore Vail, it scaled. So it became more compliant, it became slightly less inventive. Although, to be fair to Bell Labs, they did invent a number of groundbreaking inventions all the way through the 50s, the 1940s, and the 1950s. So the challenge then brings us right to this moment in time. You have got a lot of banks, for example, or insurance companies, and it makes sense that they are focused on execution, serving their customers well, keeping their policies up to date, and all of these things. And yet, there is a great competitive advantage to be gained from using cloud computing. How do they do that? How does somebody who's managed in a very rigid, and to be fair, not particularly creative way, now all of a sudden say, okay, now I've got to take this financial institutions to the cloud? That's a very hard thing to do. For that, you need trial and error processes. And for that, you need to be able to cope with failure. And in most organizations, failure is very much frowned upon. So, how do you start to fail safe in these organizations? And I think that is one of the challenges that leaders and managers face today.
Good point is that you make about the theme of failure. Traditionally we've seen failure as a sign of incompetence. But now,
that's right.
When we innovate, if I understand correctly, you're trying something that you've never tried before. Now, how can we help people in the corporate world to overcome that fear of failure?
Well, it's difficult because the fear of failure is normal. If you speak up and somebody whacks you on the head, or maybe even slaps you around the head if you're in an abusive, family unit, you learn it's not an irrational fear. So in all of these corporations that, sometimes I deal with, you see the managers or the chief executive saying, we want to embrace failure. But as soon as somebody does fail, they get a telling off or they don't make promotion. So there is saying that you want this environment, and then there's the very, very difficult work of creating it. However, what I do sometimes remind people of is there is a spectrum of failure. And so at the very end of the spectrum, you might think of this as the naughty end of the spectrum, for want of a better word, coming into the office late, coming into the office drunk, being a pest at the Christmas party. These are failures that are absolutely intolerable. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have your praiseworthy failures. So there are two ways to build a widget. Well, we try both. One of them fails and one of them, succeeds. Well, we've learned something. So nobody really thinks the trial and error process that Edison went through was really about failure. It was about navigating a successful path. So how do we, for example, reframe failure so we can look at it on a spectrum? And then frankly, you need to put people in charge, maybe people like me, or people similar to me who understand innovation and can say to somebody, well done there, that's a great failure, and excuse me, you cannot do that again. And I've been building things for 30 years, including companies. So there is a leadership element because all of that safe environment starts with the leader.
What I'm hearing you talking about, in a sense, in this thing about failure, is creating a certain culture. Is that what you're really saying?
It is, you could call it a culture, but you could also call it an environment. One of my favorite jokes is one of Thomas Edison's younger colleagues was called Martin Force, and he picked up the nickname Farting Morse. And so in these environments, whether it's, back at Menlo Park at the turn of the last century or within Netflix right now, you see leadership teams create, they use humor, they soften certain rules, they treat their technologists like adults. That is the type of environment that encourages people to fail and fail safely.
Now, our audience consists of HR professionals, and in a sense, they are responsible for helping to create that environment. Give them a couple of tips here. What are the types of things they could start doing? They've got an environment that frowns upon failure. How can they start to morph it into something that's going to be open to innovation?
Well, HR, or as they are sometimes called, people departments, is where it all begins. So it's my favorite department. So at Container Solutions, we built an absolutely awesome HR function. And we needed to do that because we needed to attract not just the people with the right hard skills, whether that's computer programming or cloud engineering, but people with the right soft skills. So the story of Netflix, you think of Netflix as a streaming service. Netflix's real story is its HR team. So I would advise your listeners to tune into that. So once upon a time, the HR gang at Netflix, they released a document, and it was the so-called Netflix culture deck. It was just a rough PowerPoint that they made a PDF out of and chucked it on the internet. Well, subsequently, it's had tens of millions of downloads, and it talks about values. So for me, HR is about value. So if for example, Netflix, value failure and value innovation, that then needs to be translated into job specifications, interview processes, and then potentially questions in the interview itself. At Container Solutions, the HR team promotes people or rewards people 50% based on how they do their job and 50% on how they live their values. So HR is hugely involved in my world of cloud computing. And then the MacDaddy of HR functions is nothing modern. It's nothing new. And I'm trying to grab the chief executives I work with and I shake them by the lapels. And I tell them to do this old fancy trick. It's called strategic HR. So when a company knows what they want to do in a year, let's say it's to move into generative AI, you have to start today to write the specs, interview the candidates and build a pipeline of talent. This is nothing modern. You don't need to learn this from me or a contemporary of mine. You can go back to the 1950s. So there is still space for really traditional HR processes. But we must remember as HR professionals that values really matter. And that's what we should hire and promote on. And frankly speaking, we should exit people from our businesses who don't live those values. So that's, I think, the practical starting point. Get that PDF from Netflix.
Okay. Now, Jamie, you seem to live at the intersection of technology and humanity. And typically, HR people are not as comfortable with technology as they should be. What types of things can you say to them that could reassure them, that could encourage them, that could motivate them to say, okay, let me start looking into this. Let me start exploring those types of things.
I would appeal to their humanity. Presently, you cannot opt out of technology and computers. I wish you could. I wish you could say computers are not for me, like you maybe could in the 1980s. You know, I enjoy going to the rugby matches. I enjoy going for walks, but computers are something that my child does. Computers are now everywhere. They're in our education system. They run the health services. They give advice that's better than our doctors can sometimes give. The reason, you asked me earlier in the podcast, why did I write this book? I wrote it because computers are not scary. If you start with a light bulb, and I know this is going to sound strange, if a light bulb is on, it can be the value zero, and if it's off, it can be one or vice versa, I should say. Well, the light bulb became the vacuum tube. The vacuum tube became the transistor, and the transistor became the microchip. So when you start from first principles, you're left at the end of the book saying, oh, artificial intelligence is nowhere near as scary as I thought. So I believe we each of us have a responsibility to ourselves, but mainly to our children and our grandchildren, to understand technologies and then shape the world that we want to live in. Because if we don't get into this fight as professionals and as parents and as members of the community, American tech billionaires will dominate what happens next. So I would say power up, learn computing and artificial intelligence on your own terms. You don't have to be an expert programmer, but there are many ways to look at computers, many lenses to look at it, whether it's through the lens of HR, society, or technology itself. But I do believe we have a responsibility to start that process.
You know, in terms of artificial intelligence, the big fear is that it's going to take my job. It's going to replace me. You know, what could you say to people that could reassure them that instead of seeing AIs competing for their job, rather completing their job?
Well, for established professionals, whether they are HR professionals or computer programmers or teachers, AI will augment their work in life. But if they cannot get up to speed with these technologies and their colleagues do, they're going to become less and less relevant to their organizations. So there is no getting away from this. People should power up. They should learn how to use it. They should learn how to test. The real challenge is, you mentioned the fear that AI will take jobs, but that's already happening. And the place it's happening is at the junior levels of organizations. So once upon a time, junior solicitors would troll through, you know, thousands of pages of documents. They would create summaries for the partners, and the partner would go to court. Well, that role is now fulfilled by an AI. So the question is when those senior partners retire to be replaced by the middle of their organization, who will replace the middle of the organization? So this, in my opinion, is a ticking HR time bomb. I trained the generation that came after me. I handed them the baton, and that generation handed it to the one that came after. If an AI is doing the entry-level positions right now, who on earth is going to bring on the next generation? Not to mention the social unrest that's happening right now because people did what their parents asked them to do. They went to university so they could get a good job, but now the good job isn't there. So I think, in short, for people in their existing roles, power up, because I'm afraid you're going to have to.
Now, I just want to explore that a little bit more because I'm hearing you kind of hinting at some strategic thinking that HR people need to engage in. What type of strategic thinking, if they're saying, okay, we need to prepare our organization and our people for what's coming,
yeah,
what are you going to say to them?
I think the first change is that all executive teams should have a HR person on the exec teams. That's not always the case in every company. So start by making HR or people a central concern of the organization. And that means when the technologists are talking about rolling out a new tool for a certain job, then the HR people know that, so they won't start to hire into that. So I think that's the very first thing. The second strategic thing would be to look at what is it that artificial intelligence can do and what is it that it can't do or that it shouldn't do. I don't think an artificial intelligence should give somebody critical feedback about their performance. So where we need empathy and care and openness, uniquely human traits, the HR team should hold on to those tasks. However, the mechanical processes of entering feedback or collecting 360-degree feedback as part of a performance review, that can be delegated to an AI. But of course, the presentation of that feedback should fall to a human. So it's almost as if taking a Venn diagram, what the hell do we do right now? What can AI do presently? What's it going to be able to do in 2 years? And what should we keep that's uniquely human? And I believe remaining uniquely human will give you a huge competitive advantage. Container Solutions is a very humane company, and we have always outperformed our peers because people want to work here. And when they work here, they don't want to leave. So any so-called hard-nosed businessman who doesn't understand that, well, I would say they're pretty foolish, actually.
Now, you mentioned the word empathy. Now, that's also another word that is... Some, as you say, the hard-nosed businessmen who come from that military style of leadership, which we inherited after the Second World War, who kind of, you know, leave your problems at home, you know, you're here to do a job. How can we help them embrace empathy? And, you know, it's not a skill that you can learn kind of step one, step two, step three. It's a quality that one's got to develop within oneself. Now, how can we do that?
Well, I the honest answer, Alan, is with great difficulty. I was about to say there is no place for these people in the future. And I should say there's no place for these men in the future because it's nearly always men. Mm-hmm. But there was no place in the past for these men either. I have on my desk what I consider to be a classic of organizational psychology. And it's just funny that you mentioned this because this is not a plant. On the Psychology of Military Incompetence from 1979.
Okay.
The best military leaders all the way through the Boer War, which is, you know, of course, in South Africa, military leaders on both sides of the conflict, the leaders who did the best were often non-traditional. They were rebels. They were visionaries. And so they had empathy for the men. They were not willing to send men to their slaughter. They preferred to take a much more strategic approach to battles. That continued all the way through the last century. If you have a man who's my age, I'm nearly 50, who hasn't developed empathy, good luck developing it in the next 10 years. What I write about in Visionaries, Rebels and Machines, there are a number of crises, and there's a brilliant moment at Intel in 1985 where the chief executive, Andy Grove, he said, this is what the historians say, he almost had an out-of-body experience and said, if I'm not fit to do this job, I might as well go out the front door and let somebody else come in who is fit for the job. Yeah. This level of self-awareness is the type of thing I'm talking about extensively right now with executive teams. Do you think you can tune into your people's fears right now about AI? Do you think you can change your behavior and normalize failure? Because if you can't, you should remove yourself and let somebody else come in who can lead this organization through the next wave of changes. Hmm. That is my present stock advice.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that you talk about mainly men, because it has been mainly men that have embraced that military model. And it's almost like they feel they're being sissies if they show their humanity, so to speak.
Yeah.
So you're right there. It's a critical move that needs to be made.
But of course, it's the opposite of being a sissy, because a brave man would be happy
absolutely
to be vulnerable.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That requires courage.
Yeah.
And that's also something that needs to be developed in the corporate world, because sometimes people don't have the courage of their convictions. They're rather, you know, I'll just keep quiet and just not rock the boat.
So you might, I don't know if this is going to make the final edit, but one of the very dark jokes I sometimes tell executive teams is this. I say the problem with many teams is they're like cephalopods, very intelligent, but lacking a spine. And there's enough brains in the business world. We're not lacking brains. Mm-hmm. We are lacking courage and empathy. Mm-hmm. The secret to my success was not intelligence, I can promise you that, but it was having the willingness to try things. And of course, my secret power was to hire a diverse management team. We had lots of female leaders in Container Solutions, and there was a reason for that. You know, female leaders have to jump through different hoops to get to the same position as a man. Mm-hmm. If you meet a lady who's an executive and she's 35, 40, I can guarantee, almost guarantee, that she's way more competent than a male equivalent at that point in their careers.
Mm-hmm. You're right there about surrounding oneself with people who think differently. You know, you don't want to hire people who think the same as you because you've already got you. So it's also, but that requires emotional intelligence and emotional maturity to be comfortable with that, you know, to not feel the need to be the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
And it's tapping into the collective intelligence, you know. I think it was Ken Blanchard that made the point. He said, none of us is as smart as all of us. And it's, you know, it's about you're smart, I'm smart, so-and-so smart. But when we put our smarts together, magic happens. So
that's right.
That requires an emotional maturity. That's great. Now, Jamie, you know, as we're wrapping up, one of the things that I've learned is that people who have written books have various views on things, and they know what they would like to be asked. What type of question would you like to be asked, and what would be the answer to that?
Oh my goodness! What type of question would I like to be asked? You've caught me off guard on that one. I think the question, the question I've tried to answer in the book, and the question that I'm asking people is, what type of world do you want to live in? And I don't mean to be morbid, but for you and I, Alan, we're at the closing end of our lives. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
So the question then becomes, what type of world do you want to leave for your children and your grandchildren? People are focused on artificial intelligence and the rise of killer robots. This is all a red herring. It's all a huge distraction. What people should really focus on are the economic indicators that right now are very similar to what they were just before the Second World War. When people are pushed into poverty, they make knee-jerk, desperate decisions and vote in the wrong people. Conflict inevitably follows. We've never had a global conflict with nuclear-armed powers. All of this is connected. So that is the real question. And I don't want to be a downer or a Debbie Downer, but the truth is that this is happening all around us. And if we don't speak and listen continuously, the future will not be dictated by us, but will be dictated by, you know, people that, you know, that are not us, that have their own agendas. So I think that's the question I've been trying to you know, answer. What type of world do we want to leave for the generation that came behind us? I like to remind people, everything we use, electricity, the internet, the telephones, all was publicly funded. So all of these technologies are built on publicly funded assets that really belong to our commonwealth. So it's not right that tech companies can then scoop off all the winnings and keep it for themselves. That is a present social injustice that's really driving a lot of misery in all of our societies.
You know, we're talking about empathy, and another quality that I found, which is very contrary to military leadership, is vulnerability. And I must just salute you in closing and wrapping up. I must salute you for your vulnerability where you said, you've caught me off guard. You were mature enough to show that vulnerability. Well done, you.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you.
Jamie Dobson, thank you so much for the time and the insights. Really appreciate it.